Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School, who explains how Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris can politically neutralize the Supreme Court's dangerous presidential immunity ruling. Bronco Marketich, a staff writer with Jacobin Magazine, who discusses his belief that the selection of Tim Walz as the Democrats' vice presidential candidate represents a significant change in U.S. politics. And John Mark Rosendahl, a musician and climate activist, who talks about his civil disobedience action arrest while playing Bach on his cello in a campaign pressuring Citibank to end their investments in fossil fuels. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
5 years ago, Chinese-American rainforest defender Brandon Lee was shot in the Cordillera region of the Philippines. The military has targeted indigenous defenders in the area. For a decade, Lee has worked with the Ifugao peasant movement, defending ancestral lands against corporations stripping the area of its natural resources. Before Lee was shot and paralyzed from the chest down, two indigenous activists with the peasant movement were killed as they organized opposition to hydropower dam projects on a river, which would end the ability of villagers to grow their food staple, rice. During his advocacy for the community, Lee, a San Francisco native, was harassed by the Philippines military, which receives U.S. funding. According to In These Times magazine, the Philippines is the most dangerous nation for environmental defenders in Asia. Over the last decade, the Philippines government was involved in over 100 murders of rainforest defenders. The U.S. government has a 50-year relationship with the Philippine military, providing $1.14 billion in military aid over the last decade. Between 2012 and 2022, nearly 2,000 peasants, farmers, fishermen, and activists were murdered globally for defending their homes from corporations seeking to strip the land for profit. The climate crisis has had far-reaching impacts across the U.S., as a growing number of extreme weather events have affected the lives of millions of Americans. One such impact is the rising cost of insurance premiums in states experiencing a record number of destructive storms. An increasing number of middle-class homeowners are now feeling the effects of climate change in their wallets. Florida is ground zero for a dramatic increase in extreme weather events. In response, the state's right-wing governor and former GOP presidential candidate Ron DeSantis pushed for the passage of insurance reform legislation, making it harder to sue insurers and forcing homeowners into more expensive policies. For the majority of the state's homeowners, the new insurance law has been a disaster. In January, Florida Democrats successfully ran against the GOP's unpopular insurance law to win a special election and flip a Central Florida legislative district that DeSantis had carried by 12 points 2 years earlier. According to the American Prospect, Democrats have an opportunity to advocate for a progressive national response to the climate-driven insurance crisis while opposing the GOP's unpopular position, which is to deny climate change is real, pin the blame for higher premiums on lawsuit abuse, and entice insurers to remain in markets through lax regulation and eliminating consumer protections. Earlier this year, 13 Republican governors opted out of a summer food program run by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The federal program makes low-income households eligible to receive $120 per child during the hot summer months when school-based lunches aren't available. Up to 21 million kids across 37 states will benefit from the program. the Republican governors cite their opposition to what they deride as welfare and their unwillingness to cover administrative costs. GOP-controlled states opting out of the food program this year include Alabama, Alaska, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Iowa, Mississippi, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming. However, 14 states with Republican governors decided to participate in the program. According to the USDA, roughly 17 million households experienced food insecurity in 2022, compared with 13.5 million in 2021 and 13.8 million in 2020. The agency defines food insecurity as limited or uncertain access to adequate food. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In recent years, the Supreme Court's supermajority of extremist right-wing justices has issued rulings that overturn decades of precedents. These rulings, dramatically out of step with the views of most Americans, include abolishing reproductive rights, gutting the Voting Rights Act, weakening gun safety and labor laws, and effectively ending affirmative action admission programs at colleges and universities. In the term completed at the end of July, the High Court followed the same pattern of disregarding congressional legislation, years of judicial precedent, and public opinion. These rulings included discarding the Constitution's prohibition on insurrectionists running for public office, invalidating some charges against January 6 rioters, allowing would-be mass murderers to purchase accessories that turn rifles into machine guns, approving racially gerrymandered congressional districts, criminalizing homeless people, legalizing bribery for state and local officials, and overturning the 40-year-old Chevron doctrine that jeopardizes environmental, climate, public health, and workplace safety regulations. But to the shock of many legal scholars, the Supreme Court's last ruling issued in the term held that presidents are entitled to absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for official acts, making it likely that future authoritarian presidents could engage in criminal acts with impunity, imperiling U.S. democracy. Your reporter spoke with Lawrence Lessig, Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School, who talks about his advice to Democratic presidential nominee Vice President Kamala Harris about the action she could take to politically neutralize the Supreme Court's dangerous presidential immunity ruling.
In response to this decision, President Biden has called on Congress to propose a constitutional amendment to reverse it. Chuck Schumer, Majority Leader of the Senate, has proposed legislation which could largely reverse it. The Supreme Court itself, the Schell case, said that Congress had the power to reverse the immunity that was being granted by the Supreme Court. Those reversals would apply not to every president, regardless of whether he or she wanted it or not. The point I made about Kamala Harris is that no president is forced to accept the gift the Supreme Court has given him or her in the form of immunity. They could say, I just waive that immunity. I'm never going to invoke that immunity. So my argument was Kamala Harris, you know, maybe at the Democratic National Convention in her acceptance speech, ought to say, look, thank you very much, Supreme Court, for this gift of immunity that you say is necessary for me to be able to do my job. I'm pretty sure I can do my job without committing any crimes or without getting any of my official actors or officials in my administration to commit crimes on my behalf. So therefore, I pledge right now that I will not invoke this immunity after I leave office, period. And that would put a challenge on Donald Trump to say whether he would invoke the immunity. And then if you have one person who says, I promise to waive any immunity because I will put myself not above the law, but subject to the law. And somebody else who says, I will not promise to waive the immunity. I will keep myself above the law. I think the voters should be able to look at those two candidates and say, why do you need to be free to commit crimes or to have your administration commit crimes on your behalf? Why do you think you need that? And my point about thinking about it in this politically competitive way is that I think that if Harris made that move, it would almost become necessary. You know, Donald Trump is already declaring he needs the immunity, so I'm not going to imagine he's going to do anything. But you can imagine it being a regular part of the campaign for president that a candidate would say, look, I waive this special extra immunity given to the president by the Supreme Court. I will not invoke immunity after I leave office for claims that I've committed crimes beyond my official duties. And that practice, if became a general practice, could in effect negate the significance of what the Supreme Court has done. Now, Kamala Harris can't affect the immunity of anybody but Kamala Harris. So this is just a person waiving the immunity for him or herself. But I do think that we could build an expectation that everybody would do that. And when everybody begins to do that, then the Supreme Court's extravagant gift of special protection for criminal acts by the president or through official acts of the president would just be irrelevant, wouldn't matter anymore.
Professor Lessig, have you heard from Kamala Harris's campaign regarding your suggestion here, which I think is brilliant and could be quite useful in blunting this immunity for future presidents? It could be a very dangerous thing for this country. Have you heard from anybody?
I've heard from people on the Hill who found the idea intriguing and interesting. You know, I think most people at this point are just really thinking about its political potential. And I think it obviously reinforces the framing around this campaign that she is trying to present. You know, she's the prosecutor, he's the felon. She as the prosecutor would be saying, look, I don't think anybody should be above the law, and I myself won't be above the law, period. Even if the Supreme Court wants to let me live above the law, I don't accept that. And challenge the other side, and that would reinforce the message. And I think that's why people on the Hill have been intrigued by the idea because they think that it would strengthen the campaign. My real interest is not so much the campaign, although, you know, I don't want to hide the fact I'm a Harris supporter. My interest is just if we could create this as a regular part of running for president, we could just solve this problem without, you know, any of the elaborate mechanisms of amendment or even a statute by Congress.
That was Lawrence Lessig, Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership at Harvard Law School. Find a link to his recent article titled How Kamala Harris Can Upend the Supreme Court's Horrible Immunity Ruling in One Move by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After President Biden's disastrous June 27th debate with former President Donald Trump, the Democratic Party's base fell into deep depression, with poll after poll indicating that Biden was headed toward defeat in the November election, and Republicans were in a good position to retain control of the House of Representatives and take over the U.S. Senate, with growing pressure from party leaders and down-ballot candidates worried that Biden was dragging their chances for election victory down with him. The president ended his candidacy on July 21st and endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, to run as the party's nominee. Not long after this historic party shakeup, Vice President Harris emerged as a unifying force within the party, generating new energy and excitement, which quickly translated into record fundraising and an impressive turnaround in polls, finding she had reversed the party's fortunes and now led in key battleground states. As she electrified large crowds at campaign rallies, her next challenge was to select a vice presidential running mate. Although conventional wisdom suggested Harris should pick a centrist candidate to appeal to suburban and moderate voters, in the end she selected Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who had a unique set of qualifications. Walz, who worked as a high school teacher, a football coach, and served in the Army National Guard, was elected to six terms representing a conservative-leaning rural Minnesota congressional district, then was elected twice as the state's governor, where he won a long list of progressive legislative victories while retaining statewide popularity. Your reporter spoke with Bronco Marketich, a staff writer with Jacobin Magazine, who explains why he believes that the selection of Tim Walz as a vice presidential candidate represents a significant change in U.S. politics.
He came in as governor when the Republicans of Minnesota controlled the state Senate. So he had divided government. You know, he didn't campaign on a very ambitious platform, but he had certain things he wanted to do. I think he wanted to pour money into education. He wanted to fix the state's infrastructure, and he was going to do it by putting a gas tax in place. He was going to keep the state's healthcare system, public healthcare system, going effectively by trying to extend a tax. And that required a lot of compromise and working with Republicans, which Walz, certainly in terms of his rhetoric, seemed to genuinely believe in. But what was, I think, unique about him is that once the period of divided government ended, which it did in 2022 with that election, once he had this very narrow majority, it was a very similar situation to what the Democrats had at the start of Biden's term. He just went full steam ahead, and him and the Minnesota legislature, it wasn't just him, it was also the Democratic Farmer Labor Party of Minnesota, they made this concerted decision that they were just going to, you know, use and spend the political capital they had accumulated over the years to pass a flurry of legislation. And, you know, the way that people have described his record is they say, oh, you know, it's a very progressive record. He did, sort of implying they did all these kind of things that are just progressive wish lists. And certainly that is true to some extent. He did a lot of things in social policy that progressives were very friendly towards, things like codifying Roe v. Wade, banning conversion therapy, certain criminal justice reforms. But he also did a lot of pro-worker things that were popular across the board. If you actually look at the polling in Minnesota, even Republicans and independents were very much in favor of things like paid family and medical leave, legalizing recreational marijuana. Some of the pro-worker reforms you made, like banning non-compete clauses for workers, for instance, that was just one of several kind of things that were done to improve worker standing. And also basically sending people, they call them Walz checks. They were these tax rebates, sending people direct checks to help them during a time of inflation. If you look at polling, a lot of people actually wanted them to be bigger. So even though he's painted as kind of this ultra-progressive governor, you know, a lot of the stuff that he did was pretty popular across party, ideological, even geographical lines, you know, the urban-rural divide in Minnesota.
You make the point in your article that Kamala Harris's decision not to pick Josh Shapiro in some ways defied conventional wisdom that a progressive candidate like Kamala Harris should pick a centrist, should pick someone who will appeal to those on-the-fence centrist voters out there. And you note that this choice really says something substantial about the change in U.S. politics. Maybe talk about that.
Yeah, back in the day, not even that long ago, Shapiro would have been the obvious choice. You know, his background, he's a lawyer, you know, went to an elite college. He is against banning fracking. He angered unions with some of his positions on school vouchers, and he wants to cut the corporate tax rate. He's a guy who has calibrated his politics to be accommodate a wide variety of right-wing positions. And that used to be kind of the common sense. This is what makes a good politician. This is what makes an accomplished politician and what makes someone popular and what will make someone an appealing candidate in U.S. politics. And that has really shifted. I mean, reportedly, one of the things that drew Harris to Walz, besides the fact that Shapiro was seen as someone who was very ambitious and wanted to be president one day and might undercut her, and Walz said, apparently, I have no plans to be president. I just want to do whatever you want me to do. But besides that was the fact that he had passed all this stuff because Harris herself is looking to do a version of what Walz had done in Minnesota on the national stage. She wants to invest in childcare and make it more affordable, for instance. There's been talk that she wants to bring back the child tax credit, make it permanent, and other certain progressive reforms. These used to be considered toxic traits for a politician, to have a record of actual accomplishments, to have actually made people's lives better in their state, to have used the money that they had, the public money that they had accrued, to make changes in people's lives that are urgent and necessary. That was always a knock on them. What Walz represents is a shift in that attitude, where if you look at the attacks on Walz that have predominated over the last 2 weeks, it hasn't really been, yeah, they call him radical, you know, but it hasn't really been about the most popular stuff that he's passed. It hasn't been about the pro-worker reforms or the universal school lunches or legalizing marijuana. None of that. It's either been reforms that have allowed more dignity for transgender people. So it's been attacks on transgender people, effectively. And it's been about the George Floyd protests, and it's been about his military service. None of that really has to do with any kind of progressive stuff he did as governor. So it shows that the Republicans even understand that this is not a useful terrain for them to fight on. I think that is a shift that began in 2016. It happened because of the Bernie Sanders candidacy. It happened, I think, also because of the Trump win, because Trump went against a lot of the orthodoxy of the Republican Party. And so I think, you know, whatever happens with this election, I think there is a real sea change that has happened here. And Walz has picked, you know, demonstrates that they're actually getting things done, doing things for people, and not just serving corporate donors and whoever else is kind of propping up your campaign. That stuff is really popular and really politically potent.
That was Branko Markotić, a staff writer with Jacobin Magazine. Find a link to his recent article titled "The Tim Walz Vice Presidential Pick Shows America's Politics Are Changing" and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since early June, a coalition of grassroots groups and national climate organizations have targeted Citibank with a series of protests in what they call the Summer of Heat. Since the Paris Climate Agreement was signed in 2015, Citibank has invested $332 billion in new fossil fuel infrastructure projects, the most of any U.S. bank. Through nonviolent direct action, including blocking the doors of the bank's skyscraper headquarters in Manhattan, activists seek to pressure Citi to end its investments in fossil fuels. Most actions end in arrests within a few minutes, but on July 18th, protesters were able to hold their ground longer by locking themselves to each other through PVC pipes. A Citibank security guard ducked under one of the pipes and grazed his head on it as he moved. He charged two protesters, who are leaders of the campaign, with assault, and subsequently got a judge to issue a restraining order against them, barring the two men from being anywhere near Citibank headquarters until the Summer of Heat campaign is over. The two leaders, John Mark Rosendahl with Extinction Rebellion New York City, and Alec Conan, director of the group's Stop the Money Pipeline, could face up to 7 years in prison for violating the order. Rosendahl and Conan decided to challenge the restraining order by appearing in a special concert in Citibank Plaza on August 8th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who has also been arrested during the campaign, spoke with Rosendahl, a professional cellist, about what happened during his civil disobedience action and arrest.
So the order of protection says that we are not to go anywhere near James Flynn, his person, his home, his business, his place of employment, his school. We're not to contact him electronically or telephonically, but it doesn't say anything about where James Flynn lives or works or any of that stuff. So our lawyers tell us it's unconstitutionally vague. And at the bottom of the sheet of paper, it says that the maximum penalty for violating an order of protection is 7 years in prison. So the idea that we assaulted anybody is so absurd. Alec and I, you know, when we talked about it, we immediately said to each other, like, we need to challenge this. And what we need to do is to go back to Citibank in the most nonviolent possible way, in the most conspicuously nonviolent way. And Alex said to me, would you be willing to play the cello at Citibank? And I said, of course. So we made the plan to go back to Citibank and present a cello performance. By the time we were ready to do it, the action on August 8th, we had 13 people who were prepared to encircle us and protect us from the cops. On August 8th, we met a couple of blocks from Citibank. We walked to Citibank. I set up my chair and in the middle of the plaza and pulled out my cello. Alec held an umbrella over me because it was raining lightly. 13 protesters stood in a circle around us. We were prepared to start the action with speeches. Alec started to speak, and then he said, John Mark, take it away. I started to speak, and Alec said, John Mark, start playing. And I said, are they coming for us? And Alec said, yes. So I started to play. Immediately after I started to play, I heard the police officer on a bullhorn saying, two people here are violating the order of protection. Anyone who interferes with their arrest will be arrested. So I kept playing. The circle around me started to get smaller, and it got smaller and smaller. The cops were pulling people out of the circle and arresting them. Eventually, the circle around me was so tight that I could not move, so I couldn't play. And then I heard protesters around me shouting, "Let him play, let him play." And in a moment, there was a police officer at my elbow arresting me. I handed off my cello, and I was escorted to a police car. We sang, "We are not afraid. We will fight for liberation because we know why we were made." Alec and I were held in central booking this time. We were in detention for 22 hours and saw a judge on Friday morning. Our movement lawyer was brilliant. He persuaded the judge to not issue a second order of protection, and we were released on our own recognizance.
The summer of heat, it's 12 weeks, and it started at the end of the first week of June. Is that the end of the summer of heat by the time you go to court? Is it over?
Yes, the scheduled summer of heat ends at the end of August, I think August 31.
I know you've been very involved. I don't know, how many times have you been arrested?
I've been arrested a total of five times with the summer of heat. The piece of this whole thing that really, really moves and compels me is the urgency of understanding that a climate justice movement has to be an anti-militarist movement. We have to oppose war because the U.S. Wars all over the globe are to a great degree motivated by the U.S.'s compulsion to control oil resources. And the wars consume and burn an enormous amount of fossil fuels. The wars pollute the land directly. The wars directly damage, destroy the Earth's capacity to sustain life. So war is an enormous part of the story of the climate crisis.
That was John Mark Rosendahl, a climate activist with Extinction Rebellion New York City, one of the groups participating in the Summer of Heat campaign. Learn more about the climate protests targeting Citibank by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KVRF in Palmer, Alaska, REC Delmarva nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.